3, we'll be continuing to look at the life of David. David's gives us so many great lessons for us to study and compare our lives with, and for us to consider how he handled so many of the challenges that came his way. Tonight we want to think about this thought of grace to the Lord's anointed, and thinking about how David refused to put Saul to death when he had opportunity. We talked the last couple weeks about how you handle having spears thrown at you, and because David dealt with that. And so we looked at this ongoing saga between David and Saul, and Saul throwing spears at him. And tonight we want to think more about the next stage in this continued drama of Saul chasing David. I want to begin by thinking about the story. And the story is, well, Linda, will you advance the slide? Maybe it's going to work now. The story involves three things that I want to mention, then we're going to make four lessons out of it. The first one is, Saul was constantly pursuing David in chapter 23, 15 through 29. So we left off, David had gone to a cave in chapter 22, and he had written some psalms in that cave. And then in chapter 23, he saves the city. And then you think David may be getting a little break from all the pursuing. And in verses 15 through 29 of chapter 23, we find that Saul is going to redouble his efforts to catch David and get him. And this causes David to have to hide and to have to flee more from Saul. Now David, in verse number 24, we read, "And they arose and went to Zip ahead of Saul, and David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah in the south of Jehemah. And Saul and his men went to seek him. And David was told he went down to the rock and lived in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men were on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, as Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture him." Now, we might recall that earlier David had said, when he spoke with Jonathan, very early on in this, that he said, "There is but a step between me and death." He felt often like Saul was just about to catch him, and then David would escape. Here we see him feeling very close to being captured again. In verse 28, so he's going to, we'll find out that Saul returned from pursuing after David because David and his men had escaped once again. David went against the Philistines, and therefore the place was called the Rock of Escape. And David went up there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. And sometimes we find that description in the Psalms when David wrote those from En-Gedi. David is constantly being pursued. We don't know for sure. I studied a little bit this week about how long this all goes on, because that's interesting to me. But the Bible doesn't give us many dating references or tell us exactly these things happen. We know that David was a young man, and exactly what that means, when he was anointed by Samuel and when he's going to slay Goliath. And that's when his popularity grows. We know that some things about Saul and how long he's going to reign. But if you kind of look at those things, and we know that David is going to reign from age 30 to age 70 as king over Judah for 7 years, and then king over all of Israel for 33 years, so a total reign of 40 years. So it is a general estimate that this saga between Saul and David went on about a decade. And once again, just a general estimate. It could have been as low as 6 years, could have been as many as maybe 12 to 15 years. But if we just think about 10 years for sake of our mind, I want you to think about how difficult that would be to live in caves, to be on the run, to constantly be feeling like you are at the point of death. And if you are betrayed at any moment, if you're captured at any moment, it would mean that you lose your life. And so this went on for so long, and we can get better understand the depth of David's desperation and why he writes some of the things that he does during this time period. In chapter 24, David is going to do something that is very famous and very remarkable. Is he's going to be hiding out in a cave. And when he's in this cave in the wilderness of En-Gedi, verse number 1, Saul took 3,000 chosen men, verse 2, chosen men out of Israel, and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goat's rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way, and there was a cave. And Saul went in, this is the exact, you know, the unfiltered version here. The Bible just tells us the way it happened. He went in to relieve himself. Now, I think the old King James said he uncovered his knees. Well, you may not exactly know that expression in the King James, but what they're trying to say is he went to the bathroom. He found a private spot in the cave to go to the bathroom. Now, when David and his men are in there and Saul comes in, they were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. I'm reading verse 4. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you." So his men's like, "Hey, we got him in a compromising position. We got him. He came into our cave. This is our chance to kill him." I mean, they're really excited about this. "And behold, I will give your enemy into your hand. You shall do to him as it shall seem good to you." So they say, "This is what the Lord said to you." Now, let me pause there real quickly. We don't really know. Did the Lord tell that to David? Did these men say that? All we have is a quote from these men saying, "The Lord said this to you." So maybe they're saying, "Hey, this is what we've been telling you. This is what you've been praying about. This is what the Lord's doing, bringing you into him to this cave. This is your chance." Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, I don't know if his robe was on him, because it seems impossible almost for him to be able to do that with Saul being awake and in that private situation. But it seems that you could devise various scenarios that could have happened. He could have probably laid his robe somewhere to the side. He moved away. Anyways, all we know is that David got a hold of his robe, and he was right there that close to him, and he cut off a corner of his robe. And afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now his conscience is struck. Once again, this is interesting, but we don't really know why his conscience is struck. Is his conscience struck because he felt bad that he was going to kill Saul and he went there to kill him, and then when he gets there, he can't kill him, and he realizes that's not the right thing to do, and he only cuts a part of his robe? And so he feels bad because he thought, you know, man, I was about to kill him. I just averted myself at the last moment. Or is his conscience struck that he cut off a corner of the robe and it's like he was defiling the king by cutting off his robe? Once again, we're not for sure. He said to his men, "The Lord forbade that I should do this thing to my Lord." So David clearly understood that it would have been against the Lord's will for him to kill Saul. And he calls him the Lord's anointed. "To put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Now, because of time, we can't read all of this, but David then is going to call out to him in verses 8 and following, and he's going to basically say, "Hey, I could have killed you. Here's the corner of your robe to show that. This should show you that I'm not out to get you. That I'm like a flea," he says. "You know, I'm not someone that's dangerous to you." Well, Saul then will respond in verse 16. "When David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, 'Is this your voice, my son David?' And Saul lifted up his voice and wept." Saul is broken down to tears. Calls him his son. "He said to David, 'You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. You have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, and that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands.'" And then he uses an illustration, you know, it's normal basically to kill your enemy. And he says, "I know that the Lord's going to establish the kingdom in your hands, but only do this. Swear to me that you will not kill my offspring, that you'll not kill my sons when you become king." And David swore an oath that he would not kill his sons. Now, they will then separate. We'll comment on that later. The third thing I want to point out tonight before we make some lessons from these stories is from chapter 26. So chapter 25, we're not going to notice. That involves a separate account of David and Abigail, and it doesn't involve Saul, so we're going to skip that. Chapter 26, we're skipping it for now at least. In chapter 26, David is on the run from Saul again. Once again, we don't know how much time has gone on. We might assume it's been 6 months, a year, 2 years. It could have been only a few weeks. I don't know. But there's some time has passed. I would assume it's a significant, at least, amount of time. And he is on the run again. And Saul has arose with his 3,000 men and gone down to chase him once again out in the wilderness, another wilderness area at this time. And they're asleep in the camp. And David and his right-hand man, we might say, Abner, the commander of his army, they go down in, Abner is Saul's commander, and they sneak down into the camp. And David said, verse 6, to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, who will go down with me into the camp to Saul? So David's going to sneak down into camp. And Abishai said, I will go down with you. Verse 7, David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul sleeping with the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then said Abishai to David, God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear. I will not strike him twice. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But take the spear that is in his head, that is at his head, and the jar of water, and let us go. That will lead then to when Saul wakes up the next morning. David is on the other side of the mountain, and he begins to call out to him, and he says, look, this is your spear, this is your jug of water. In verse 17 and following, Saul recognized David's voice, and he's going to basically say a similar thing about how David is more righteous than him. In verse 21, Saul said, I have sinned. Return to my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake. And David said, here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Verse 25, Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David, for you will do many things and will succeed in them. So David went to his way, and Saul returned to his place. There's a lot of things in those stories. We like to tell those stories to our kids in Bible school. Good stories. Let's think about four lessons that I have drawn from these stories, and I hope they'll be a blessing to you. The first lesson, Saul is a study in self-deception. He's a study in self-deception. If you think about the passages that we looked at, I don't know if you noticed, but some of those passages I read that included the dialogue of Saul, he referred to the Lord a lot. He's even, if you think about, and we have not done a character study, I've been focusing on David, but we've studied a lot about Saul too, haven't we? But when you study the life of Saul, you also realize that he did a lot of good things, especially early on in his life. And was very dedicated in many ways to the Lord, and the Lord's going to use him in unique ways. Here in these passages that we've observed, chapter 23, chapter 24, and 26, Saul, when he talks about and he's dialoguing with David, he talks about the Lord and what the Lord had planned and what the Lord desired and about how the Lord had appointed David and the Lord will be done and things like that. And I think that's interesting because Saul talked a good talk, and he understood the Lord's basic authority and the Lord's divine presence and knowledge, but it obviously did not translate into how he acted. And the Lord's Spirit had departed from him, and he did not live a life that was consistent with that talk. And so he was self-deceived. Saul saw the virtue in David. If you look at chapter 24, 17 through 20, he talks about how David is so righteous and how he's such a righteous man. And he says it again in chapter 26 about how good David is and how righteous David is. It's like he understood that David was right. He was like a flea. He really wasn't presenting any challenge to him. And he understood that David could have done him harm. He said, it's normal for someone to kill his enemy. Why would you not kill me? He understood how righteous David was. And even when David pleads with him to quit chasing me, quit striving to kill me, let's just, make amends and stop this and allow me to come back into the palace and do things. And of course, we've already studied how that's already gone on two or three times before. Saul never believes it and accepts it. In fact, he continues to be so jealous of David. He saw the virtue in David, but he still was continued on his path. Saul vigorously protected his own position and his power, even though he understood that, as he says, David is going to be king. The Lord has anointed him to be the future king. And even though he understood that David wasn't trying to take that position now, and he understood that God was going to bring that about in his time, and David was not going to kill Saul, and that David was righteous, Saul still vigorously defended his own position and power and lived constantly jealous and constantly protecting that. Even asking David to swear of oath that he would not kill his own children one day. Saul was self-deceived. When you think about this concept, there are many Sauls in the world today. You and I can be a Saul sometime, can't we? We can talk a lot about the Lord. In fact, if we've been in the church a long time, we know the right language, the right lingo, the right things to say. And we can talk a good talk. But sometimes, as we're even saying those things, we in our heart of hearts know we're not doing those things. Or maybe we can talk to someone and say, I'll pray for you. I'm really sad you're going through this. But inwardly, we may be rejoicing that they're going through that. We can be self-deceived. We can be like Saul. And we live in a world today who we can be like David or like Saul here, who we can see the virtue in others and see the good in others, but not respond to them in that way, but vigorously protect out of fear our own position and our own power. And I would say that some are the Lord's anointed. What I mean by that is, it is the case that just as it was then, it is the case today that oftentimes leaders in the church and in the culture, in the community, and just leaders in the home are self-deceived. It may be a father who is in the home who thinks he's acting in a loving way to his wife, but in actuality is very self-deceived in that. It might be a preacher in the church. It might be an elder in the church or a deacon in the church who thinks he's doing things out of sincerity, but in actuality he's doing things out of protection of his own power, of his own position, maybe out of financial reasons, and he's self-deceived in that. It's the case that you hear something come out where there's been a lot of greed. Maybe it's a real reputable townsman, a mayor or a police chief, or even in the church, someone that has a position, and it all comes out that there was a lot of greed and there was a lot of swindling and money embezzling or something like that. And you think, how could that happen? That guy, that person, I mean, they seem so sincere. They seem so good. They seem like they were doing things righteous. And I believe lots of times we can live a double life, can't we? And we can live a double life where we're doing one thing here and we're acting one way, and it almost becomes, in our own mind, we compartmentalize this. That's who I am. But then there becomes this other life. I mean, some men have carried on entire two families in two different places. And they've been leaders in the church while doing it. We can be self-deceived. And sometimes those people who are self-deceived, though it doesn't make sense, are the Lord's anointed. In other words, they've been put in a position by God, and we still respect them and we respect that position. And we're supposed to. I want to read this chapter that was helpful. This is a book that about David and Saul. And this is a short little chapter that I want to read about Saul. And this is a narrative, kind of fictionalized account, but he makes a good point about Saul here. What kind of man was Saul? Who was this one who made himself David's enemy? The deliverer of Israel, the anointed of God. Forget the bad press, forget the stinging reviews, forget his reputation, look at the facts. Saul was one of the greatest figures of human history. He was a farm boy, a country kid who made good. He was tall, good-looking, and well-liked. He had been baptized, he had had the Spirit of God, and we see that in his life, especially early on. He also came from a good family. In his lineage were some of the greatest historical figures of all humanity: Abraham, Jacob, Moses. They were all his ancestors. Do you remember his background? Abraham had founded the nation. Moses had set the nation free. Joshua gave his people a toehold on the land that God had promised them. Saul himself united a people and founded a kingdom. He was the first king. Few men had ever done that. He created an army out of thin air. He won battles in the power of God, defeated the enemy again and again, as few men have ever done. Furthermore, he had even prophesied some. The Spirit had given him power and authority as a king. He was everything people today are seeking to be. He was a leader. He was good looking. He was in a great position. He was powerful. Yet he was also eaten with jealousy, filled with self-importance, and willing to live in spiritual darkness. Is there a moral in these contradictions? Yes. And it will splinter a lot of your concepts about power, about great men and women who have been blessed by God. Many pray and desire the power of God more every year. Those prayers may sound powerful, sincere, godly, without ulterior motives. Hidden under such prayer and fervor, however, are ambition, a craving for fame, the desire to be considered a spiritual giant. The person who prays such a prayer may not even know it, but dark motives and desires can be in his heart. As people pray these prayers, they are hollow inside. There is little internal spiritual growth. Pray for power is quick and in a short way to circumnavigate internal growth. When you think about God, why does God give unworthy people his power, he says, even though they are a pile of dead men's bones? Why does God do such thing? Why did God give Saul such power? He says the answer is both simple and shocking. He sometimes gives unworthy vessels a greater portion of power so that eventually others will see the true state of their nakedness within that individual. In other words, the truth will always come out. Eventually, Saul got seen for what he was. So, think again, he says, and I would say this to young people, say this to all of us. When you get focused upon all the gifts that God has given us, when you get focused on all the blessings and all the opportunities, remember that all those opportunities come with responsibility and that we must remain humble through it all. And so, he concludes this section, and I'll move on. What does this world need? Gifted men and women, outwardly empowered, he asks, or individuals who are broken and inwardly transformed? Keep in mind that some who have been given the very power of God have raised armies, defeated the enemy, brought forth mighty works of God, preached and prophesied with unparalleled power and eloquence. But they've also thrown spears, hated other people, attacked others, plotted to kill, prophesied naked as Saul did, and even as Saul did, consulted witches. Yes, Saul had tremendous talent, and he had tremendous power, but he allowed that to be used for negative things. Number two, David was discouraged, desperate, and depressed. If you think about chapter 20, verse 3 here, "But David vowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes, and do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.'" In chapter 22, we read about, in verses 1 and 2, how he drew all these bitter people toward him and how he was discouraged in that cave. David, in chapter 27, is going to be on the run. And he's going to have to flee to the Philistines, and he goes to Gath. He has to run down to the city of Gath to Achish, who is at Gath, the leader of the Philistines. But I want you to think about this for a moment. Gath was the city of Goliath. It was Goliath of Gath. How low did David get? He got so low that he had to flee to the Philistines, to the enemies, to the giant's hometown. Now think about that. How do you think David was received when he went into that town? This is going to be a time where he has to even deceive. David has to go into deception mode. He goes to the enemy to escape, and then he's going to become deceitful in his actions with the enemy. He begins to lie to Achish, and we won't go into all the details there, but in chapter 27, he's lying to Achish because of where he says he's running raids. He's actually running raids against foreign nations, but he tells them he's running raids against Judah and against his own people. He lives in the land of enemy, it says in chapter 27, 16 months. He was discouraged. He was desperate. He was depressed. When you think about what David was at this time, you think about how David reminds us many times of the challenges and trials we go through, and how David wrote some of those great songs because he knew what it was like to be depressed, to be desperate, to be discouraged. We don't believe that any of his psalms were written during this period. You could argue that David, during this period, kind of walks away from God a little bit, that he gets wrapped up in the enemy, and he gets wrapped up in the discouraged time, and he kind of leaves God for a time, and he goes into the ways of the world, and he lies, he begins killing whole villages, he does some things that we're like, that doesn't sound like David. And in chapter 30, when he had been away, his wives and his children and all the wives of his men are taken by the Amalekites. And when they are taken, this causes, in chapter 30, verse 3, this causes David and his men, they came to the city, they found it burned with fire, their wives and sons and daughters had been taken captive. And David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. They cried so much they didn't have any more tears to cry. David's two wives had been taken captive. Reads their names there. And then David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him. His own people said, "David, we're tired of following you. We're going to stone you. You've cost us our wives. We're done." And then the Bible says, "Because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God." It could be argued that David had gone through the period of 16 months being away from the Lord, being in this desperate time period. And then when this tragedy happens, David says, "I got to get my life right. I'm not doing things right. I got to turn back to the Lord." And David strengthened himself in the Lord his God, and he asked the ephod in verse 7. He asked Abiathar to bring the ephod, the way of determining the will of the Lord. And he says, "God, should I pursue these people?" And God tells him to pursue them, and he goes and he will get back his wives and he will rescue the children. But here's the thing there. David turned back to God. Sometimes I think in our overly happy-oriented culture, we're right here at Christmas. It's supposed to be a merry Christmas. It's supposed to be a happy time. We want to have, everybody gets married, and we want to have a happy marriage, right? I mean, that's what we want. We want our kids to grow up and have happy lives. We want all these things happy. And I understand that that's certainly what I want. That's what we want. We in our culture, you know, the pursuit of happiness, said Thomas Jefferson. And so we push that so much that sometimes we forget that it's not a sin to be discouraged, desperate, and depressed. That we're going to have times in life, and yay, everybody is, if they live long enough, are going to have times in life where they go through discouragement, maybe even depression, and maybe even desperation. And David certainly illustrates this. And I think our culture sometimes doesn't know how to handle that. We don't want that. We don't even want people crying sometimes. And so we often hide that. But I think if we can be honest with it and look to God for help and look for strength and look for examples in the Bible where we find that strength, it can be a blessing for us. Number three, David respected the Lord's anointing. Seth, you got to watch. What time is it? 6:48. I told you I was dangerous for the preacher's watch to break. My watch broke yesterday, and it's trouble. All right, let's pick up speed. Notice Amanda was quick to say, I got a watch. David respected the Lord's anointed. Let's move on. So he keeps emphasizing the Lord's anointed here. And even later after Saul is killed, he mentions that. And why would he not kill him? This is one of the most important points we can make here. Why would David not kill Saul? David didn't have any problem killing anybody. I mean, he killed entire villages. He's going to kill numerous people from Goliath on down. In fact, he'll kill the man who killed Saul because Saul, that man took joy in killing Saul or felt pride in it. So why would David not do it? David would not kill him because he was the Lord's anointed. Because he did not have the authority to depose him from the kingship. He was in a position. It's like in the Marines. Not that I've been in the Marines. But you are taught to salute the position, not the man. And God has ordained certain positions that are deserving of respect, irrespective of the immorality, irrespective of the sinful actions of the person. And David said, it's not my place. It's not my place to kill him. It's up to the Lord to depose him. If the Lord wants to do that in battle, if the Lord wants to strike him dead, however the Lord wants to do it, it's up to the Lord. But I'm not going to take it into my hands to do it. Now, who are the Lord's anointed today? Well, I think who are the Lord's anointed today is simply those who are still in positions of authority and leadership. Paul makes this clear in Romans 13. It's clear in the church that when a man is in a position of leadership, there is a given a biblical respect and authority that must be given to him because of him being the Lord's anointed. And so we ought to make sure we respect our elders, our shepherds. There's a certain position and respect that goes with serving as a deacon in the church. Even a certain respect that goes for those who are preachers in the church. And I think sometimes we can have I've seen even, especially in these younger generation, as things come on, as preachers get older, lots of times we want to look and have a disrespect sometimes on older preachers compared to younger guys. But guys that have served in the ministry and preached for years, they deserve respect for the service they've rendered. When you think about positions of authority, it would extend to civil authority as well. And so there's a real sense of where we as Christians have to recognize that man, I may disagree with him on some things, or he might have handled some things differently, but I'm going to respect him. I'm going to give him the authority due to him in that position he's in because the Lord does. And this goes for children and parents. This goes all the way to different categories. But that when the Lord has anointed someone, and obviously I'm not talking about physically anointing with pouring oil, but He has anointed them by that position they carry, then we have to give respect to it. They can do wrong and abuse. There have been many who have done wrong, whether physical abuse, sexual abuse. We hear a lot about that today, and that's so sad and terrible. There have been elderships that have made wrong choices and done, even maybe abused things. There's been preachers, there's been deacons, there's been sheriffs and mayors and presidents and other government officials that have done those things. Saul did those things. But Saul was still deserving of a level of respect because he was the Lord's anointed. God will deal with His anointed. God will deal with His anointed. It's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of the living God. I would not in any way want to be Saul on the day of judgment, would you? God dealt with Saul. And that's what David's saying. God's going to deal with Saul. It's not my place. And so God will deal with the Lord's anointed. Our job, and hear me on this, our job is to give grace and give respect. Give grace. David gave grace and he gave respect. Let us give grace to our leaders. Let us give respect to our leaders. The final point, and this is a quick one, David did not act foolishly. After Saul said those kind things, in 24, 26, 27, Saul had that dialogue. David did not. Even though Saul said, you know, hey, I'm not going to. Basically, he says, you know, I'm sorry, I repent. David did not go back into a relationship with him. And so David refused to take revenge. But not taking revenge did not mean trusting Saul and putting his trust back in him. Linda, go ahead and advance that slide, that point there. Even though he did not take revenge, he wisely did not trust in Saul. Saul went back, David went back. You can advance it to the final slide now. So as we think about these lessons, there's a lot there. I hope they've been a blessing. We've covered a lot of ground. But I hope that we can think about how David had such an attitude toward the Lord's anointed. I hope we can learn some lessons from Saul and learn from lessons about how David handled that in his life. May we give grace and may we give respect to those who are the Lord's anointed. This evening, if you're not a child of God and you need to put Christ on in baptism, we'd love to assist you in doing that. If you need to rededicate your life, please come as together we stand and as we sing.